You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. It's that time of year again where our thoughts naturally turn toward gratitude. And while we're grateful, maybe it's time for us to get smarter about gratitude. Our guest today will help us do just that. Dr. Glenn Fox is a faculty member at the University of Southern California's Lloyd Greif Center for Entrepreneurial Studies in the Marshall School of Business. His current projects focus on neural systems for emotion regulation, high-stakes training, and developing entrepreneurial mindset skills in founders and business leaders. Glenn received his PhD in neuroscience from USC, where he focused on the neural correlates of gratitude, empathy, and neuroplasticity. Prior to joining Marshall as a faculty member, Glenn led the Performance Science Institute at USC, where he worked with the U.S. Marine Corps, Army Research Laboratories, the Seattle Seahawks, and numerous Olympic athletes and Fortune 500 companies to examine the role of mindset in business and high-stakes pursuits. Currently, Glenn is the director and founder of the USC Found Well Initiative, which aims to understand and promote entrepreneurial mindset in founders and business leaders. He also serves as a principal investigator at the USC Sensory Motor Assessment and Rehabilitation Training Center in Virtual Reality Center, and a fellow of the Brain and Creativity Institute. Outside of USC, Glenn serves as a chief science officer of the C4 Foundation, which serves to strengthen and protect Navy SEAL families. Glenn is also currently on the advisory board of the Flow Research Collective, where he works with Stephen Kotler on projects related to gratitude, flow, and high performance. He consults regularly with companies and media outlets on topics ranging from small business management, gratitude, and high performance. Glenn is an avid maker and restorer of things old and metal. He lives in LA with his wife and son. So Glenn, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Joe.
So gratitude is something that appears simple, but there's more to it than meets the eye. How do you define and explain what gratitude is?
Starting with a question that requires a good amount of thought. You know, gratitude is a word we hear thrown around a lot, and I think that's a good thing. And we only begin to understand gratitude more the more we begin to look for it. And as you start to look and observe gratitude, you realize that it's so much more than what people talk about. We hear the word gratitude and we think about it as a synonym for happiness a lot of the time. But this limits what gratitude, what I think gratitude really is and what it really can do for people, is that it's more than gratitude, or it's more than happiness. It's more than just getting something nice. It is a framework. It's part of our moral compass for how we keep track of our relationships to others. It's part of our deepest motivational circuits. It's deeply wrapped in our circuits for making meaning out of what happens. Chances are, if you can find a way to be grateful for a difficulty, that difficulty will be twice reduced. And not saying that's easy, but it is showing that gratitude has more uses and more benefits than I think just happiness. So I've said what gratitude is not. I've said that gratitude is not just happiness or feeling good. Two things I'm a fan of, by the way, of course. But gratitude is more than that. So to outline what gratitude is, let's think about it in terms of the context that most of us discuss it. That is in the context of interpersonal gift giving when a recipient receives a gift of some sort from a donor. In this case, we define gratitude as the feeling that we can have when we receive something that comes at some effort and that fulfills a need. And it's a very simple definition, but it opens us up for a lot of inquiry into how gratitude can take on the wide range of experiences that it encompasses. You can have a little bit of gratitude for something like someone holding a door for us, or you can have overwhelming levels of gratitude for something as profound as an organ transplant, right? So in each of these cases and in everything in between, you can usually reduce gratitude down to one of these two factors, effort or need. Effort encompasses everything we perceive about the giver. It encompasses what we perceive about their intent, about what they gave compared to what they could give, you know, so the context. It encompasses pretty much everything that we think. Now, note, perceive is a very important word here because we never really know what's on someone else's mind, period. And we really don't necessarily know what is in their mind when they give us a gift. And that actually allows us a little bit of freedom to see the gift either in a way that can help us elevate our feeling of gratitude, or even maybe deregulate it, to be honest, or regulate it down a little bit in the case where you understand more about, perhaps in the most cynical take, and this is as much as I'll say, but there are times when people give with an ulterior motive, of course. I think that looking at someone's effort, you know, occasionally it'll pay off like that. But typically, when we're talking about gratitude, we're talking about gifts that are at least meant to be beneficial to the person. We're not talking about the gifts that are meant to manipulate people, though that absolutely does happen. And actually, I find that the more grateful we become, we actually can kind of transcend the transactional nature of gratitude a little bit. So we'll talk about that. But as a starting point, gratitude is that feeling of noticing that we've received something that helps us. It can help us. This is the need side of the equation, that it's something that helps us with a psychological need, with a personal need, a need for meaning, a need for connection, or something even quite utilitarian, like a need to fix a broken pipe or something at a home. So this is our space, which I call gift space. I call it gift space, which is the space encompassed by the range of effort that can go into a gift and the range of needs that we take into the moment of receiving or noticing a gift. Now, this model is overly simplistic, but it's a great place to start. If you start looking for gratitude, then you will notice that it varies considerably based on the social, environmental, and personal context under which it takes place. For instance, our gratitude for a gift is also highly wrapped into the social hierarchy and context and closeness of the people around us. So you may feel differently about a gift coming from your boss or supervisor compared to a gift coming from your children or something like that. And so all of these multi-level factors play into what makes us grateful. But by providing even a half-fitted model to gratitude, we begin to unpack it in such a way that we can nurture it, cultivate it, and generate it. Now, the benefits of gratitude are quite profound. We can dive into those as you like. But I think that hitting people over their head too much about try to be grateful, try to be grateful, try to be grateful can backfire pretty quickly, can lead to a lot of feelings of guilt, and can turn people off from what should be a very enjoyable and relieving practice. So we start by defining gratitude, and we start by defining it based on the fact, just a quick rehash of this, that it's not the same as happiness. So when we're practicing gratitude, we're not saying things are great when they are not. We're not saying that you can be happy all the time with a little gratitude. We're not saying that. What we are saying is that gratitude is like every other emotion. It's not just one thing. there is no single gratitude network in the brain. Gratitude is a tapestry of related positive emotion that has to do with some amount of our inner state and our perception of the world's ability to nurture it. And in so defining gratitude, we gain the tools to understand and cultivate it through daily practice.
Glenn, you mentioned the benefits of gratitude. What are they?
How much time you got?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's two ways to think about this. And it helps to think about it in these two ways. So let's talk about them in terms of state and trait. So a state is a momentary experience of any given thing. This is a state of awareness, a state of gratitude, et cetera, a state of happiness, a state of whatever. Trait is referring to our personality traits. In other words, and it refers to our proneness to see the world a specific way, to talk to people or not talk to people a specific way, to frame challenges according to how we are predisposed to doing so. We study gratitude in terms of states and traits. Both have shown to have immense benefits. So let's start with traits. In studies of gratitude as a trait, what researchers will do is measure how, using a questionnaire, a simple, most of the time it's the same six-item questionnaire called the GQ6. And it measures just generally how likely is someone to be grateful, to notice gratitude and to feel gratitude on a daily, weekly basis, just as a measure of their own proneness to feel gratitude in general. So their trait, right? How grateful of a person is someone. In this case, gratitude, the trait, predicts subjective well-being better than nearly any other personality metric. So if you had to pick between being a grateful person or someone who is extroverted, someone is agreeable, low neuroticism, you know, the big five as they're called, gratitude is a better predictor of subjective well-being than any of those big five core personality traits. It's also independent of those traits, which is a big relief, by the way. Most of the time people think, oh, a grateful person is this ebullient and expressive, extroverted, happy-go-lucky kind of person. This research shows that just about anybody can access gratitude. Now, gratitude is correlated with things like lower neuroticism, higher conscientiousness. So there are individual metrics on the big five scale that correlate with gratitude, of course. But overall, anyone, what the research has shown, that gratitude is more or less independent of these traits and other traits in general. And therefore, the fact that gratitude is a stronger predictor of any of these traits for well-being indicates that it's something that's accessible to anyone, regardless of their personal disposition. Other studies have shown that people who are more prone to gratitude tend to be more resilient, tend to handle life transition better, and tend to be more optimistic. Now, the optimism is my other favorite topic, even though I'm not an optimism researcher at the moment. I'm working on those studies as we speak. But optimism is maybe the only other trait or state that's more predictive of better outcomes than gratitude. And so the three, by the way, if I can have a short digression, the three personality traits that are most predictive of subjective well-being and happiness are gratitude, purpose, and optimism. Those are the big three. It's really tough to have someone, if you're doing well on all three of these things, that you're grateful for every day, you have a higher purpose that you're working on, that can mean anything that's larger than oneself, that matters to ourselves. And you have a sense of optimism, meaning you have a belief that what we do right now can influence the future. Those three tendencies are the most important predictors for health and happiness that we found psychologically. And they're all practicable, which is great. And that brings me to my next part, which is gratitude, the state. So there's the kind of, we have the trait, which I described, which is how prone we are. The state means what happens when we practice gratitude, when we feel gratitude, when we notice gratitude, when we receive something that makes us feel gratitude. And this is where I've spent most of my research. Pretty much all of my research has based on gratitude, the state. Now, it's much harder to capture. It's harder to predict. One of the jokes about gratitude, it's actually not a joke, it's actually a real thing, is one of the best ways to get rid of gratitude in someone is to tell them to be grateful. You will wipe out whatever goodwill you had is to say, hey, be grateful for that. They're going to be like, nope. Like, you could have gotten a new car, you could have gotten a kidney. And if someone says, hey, be grateful for my kidney, they're going to go, I'm less grateful. It's just how it works. So I don't know. So anyway, so the state of gratitude is hard to capture. And I'll spare all the methodological details here because I don't think it's too pertinent right now. But we were able to create and induce a wide variety of gratitude in our participants by having them bear witness to stories of survivors from the Holocaust. And these stories varied, and pretty much every survivor story that we found had stories of immense, profound human dignity, sacrifice, and giving. This is also part of this tragic history, and I believe these stories also deserve to be told. So we had our participants, normal college students and graduate students, take on the perspective of the survivor and imagine themselves receiving these gifts. That's how we created the state of gratitude. In our research, we saw that this state was associated with a reduction in heart rate overall. And we found that some of the brain regions involved in processing these gifts were those associated with interpersonal bonding and joy. So the state of gratitude is, in other studies where they have tried to get people to practice gratitude on a daily basis, daily or even weekly basis, to be honest, on a regular basis, found that people who regularly practice focusing on gratitude show other immense benefits as a result of practicing the state of gratitude. So they show reduced symptoms in stress. They show reduced symptoms of physical discomfort. And more fun than that, they show more tendency to exercise. And there's all kinds of stuff coming out now. I mean, to be honest, thank goodness, like, gratitude research is blowing up. I wanted to go more. If there are any neuroscientists out there or people going into grad school for neuroscience, please study neuroscience and gratitude. I haven't scanned a brain in a few years. There's just wide open questions to study gratitude in the brain. I just wish more people would do it. I don't know why it didn't take off the way I thought it would. But there's great stuff, the behavioral stuff, meaning the psychological stuff, the questionnaires, the interventions, the journaling, all these things are coming out all the time, showing great benefits to gratitude. Now, to get those benefits, by the way, you have to try a little bit. You have to put a little bit of energy in. A lot of the variance in the experiments, in the effectiveness of gratitude, you know, will give you superpowers. Will it make my gray hair on the side of my head turn black to brown? I don't know. I don't need my hair. I like to call it like a metallic coat. You know, you spend a lot of money on a nice paint job for a car to get that nice metallic sheen. That's how I think of my temples now. But I've paid for those gray hairs and they mean something to me now, entering middle age. But, you know, will gratitude fix all that right away? No, but it will make me appreciate other things. And maybe it will. I don't know. Maybe there's some edge cases where it can. But so what we're saying when we look at the effectiveness of these gratitude interventions overall is that they vary quite a bit. It's not a magic bullet. Some show that gratitude has profound benefits. Some show minor benefits or no benefit. But a lot of it has to do with putting the effort in. If you really sit down and you take 5 deep breaths and write down things you're grateful for and really try to cultivate it and really bake it in, I think it's pretty much a near guarantee. As much, I'm not really comfortable saying that, but it's a very good chance based on previous research that you're going to feel great over time. You're going to feel a lot better. You know, is it going to solve problems? I don't know. The research shows that it produces, across all the different intervention studies, it produces on average, a small but noticeable difference. In certain studies, you see incredible things. So I think on average, I think a lot of it comes down to how we practice it. There are limits to it, but I think a lot of it comes down to our desire and our nuance. And I think also too, paying attention to the varieties of gratitude will make a big difference in how we leverage its benefits. I know personally, as a gratitude researcher, I'm basically paid to say this, but personally, I've practiced gratitude for so many years, and there's days I really struggle with it. But overall, my arch is to say, okay, I can always find something to be grateful for. And Bob Emmons, who is the preeminent gratitude scholar, he and I had a wonderful exchange. Bob is just a fantastic human. And he and I had this debate, or it came up at one of the conferences we went to, where he really defined gratitude as something that is always available. We can always find something to be grateful for. And that's kind of a hard burden, because sometimes you really don't feel it. But you think about it in terms of unpacking what are the elements of gratitude, what goes with it. And you see, yeah, there always are going to be something to be grateful for. If it's one single breath left or any aspect of our body that's functioning well at any given time, congrats, you've got something. Even if you're like really hurting, you've got like, I just had a kid, so my whole side of my body is like killing me from cradling him around and wrestling with him and stuff. And so I didn't know that was part of parenting, of like hurting all the time, but maybe it's because I'm an older parent. But so I'm noticing my neck and shoulder, but I'm like, you know, my left hand is like, my left arm and shoulder is going great. I could be grateful for that, or I could focus on the pain in my neck. So it's not making light of these things. Of course, there are days when things are truly, truly awful. And it's not saying, but you could always be this, or at least you can be grateful for that. But we can recognize that there are opportunities to be grateful even in the darkest of times.
So what tends to get in the way of experiencing gratitude?
Such a great question. I think it's really just a misunderstanding of defining gratitude correctly in the beginning. I think by focusing too much on gratitude as just the happiness thing, people stop trying to focus on gratitude, and therefore it can be an inhibitor. My friend Phil Watkins published this great paper a few years ago about gratitude and cynicism, and how people, if we're very cynical about what the world owes us, humble enough to treat things as gifts that we don't deserve, if we're feeling entitled to XYZ benefits, these things will inhibit gratitude or extinguish it completely. In terms of people working to be grateful, leaving out the cases of people who are more cynical or bitter, I'm guessing in terms of your audience here listening to the discussion, they're thinking, great, that's not really me. What do I do? What gets in my way? And for the rest of us, then I think it's more about really just having a practice in which we notice it and pay attention to it. I mean, I think it's as simple as paying attention. So there's ways to nudge ourselves to feel grateful. Leave your gratitude journal on your desk so that when you go to work, you've got to move your gratitude journal, or put it by the side of your bed. So every time you go to bed, you have to like turn on, you know, move your gratitude journal and turn on your light. And so you go, oh, I better fill this thing out right now. So little nudges like that, I think, can make a big difference. And soon you're starting to pay attention. So I really think the biggest hurdle, honestly, I think is just not treating it like a skill, treating it like a trait that you're either born with or you have or you don't. And that's completely false. So treating it as a skill to be developed, and then designing ways so that we pay attention is the best way. So we lose gratitude when we're not paying attention to what's around us, when we're not paying attention to the present moment. And we all do this. I say we intentionally. I'm not saying, you know, this is me. I'm right there with you. That's when I notice it personally, is like, oh, if I design my life to practice this a little better, I get more of it. So that's really, it's as simple as paying attention, but the ramifications of that are pretty profound in terms of setting our life around our mental health and mental recovery and mental flourishing.
So Glenn, I'm curious, what practices do you personally use to keep the right amount of gratitude in your life?
I like that you use the right amount, the term right amount, because I think gratitude, being that it's a skill, and I think the evidence suggests that it is a skill, if it's a skill, then it needs to be practiced as a skill, not as something to be used as a one-size-fits-all hammer, so to speak. It's not a sledgehammer, right? It has many different uses, and we can talk about this a little bit, but part of that is to say, look, you don't necessarily need to feel effortful maximum gratitude all the time. For instance, we all know it's correct to say thank you to people who work in the service industry. And it's, you know, if someone makes you a coffee at a coffee shop, the correct thing is to say, hey, thank you. This is great. Now, should you be like falling on your knees and crying like, this is the best coffee ever? If it is the best coffee, do it. It depends on the coffee, right? But typically the right answer is to be properly grateful, to notice the gratitude. And you can do your own gratitude meditation where you think about, boy, it took the whole world to create this cup of coffee, which it really did. But in that moment, the skill of gratitude is applying the right amount for everyone there. And it's probably a little more than we normally do, right? So when it comes time to practicing and showing the right amount, a lot of it comes back to that regulation and that practice of it and allowing us to hone in on the proper amount of skill overall. I have a gratitude journal that I keep on my desk that I update periodically. There's good research too showing that you don't necessarily need to do a gratitude entry every single day, that as frequently as once a week can make a great difference for us. For me, because I've been practicing it so long, I hope folks can take my word for it. So one is, I think that writing it down is kind of the gold standard. Sending thank you notes and writing it down is kind of the gold standard way to practice. And I'm regular, if not sporadic, in terms of how often I'm writing it down. But I do have, at this point, I've been practicing so long, I can say this with confidence and with humility, though, that like I do take time to notice things that are going well every single, all the time. I make a point to put my feet on the ground every morning and put my feet on the ground. And even if I'm feeling really crummy and my son woke up super early and that's been a long night, I was grading till 10:30 and now I'm up at 5:30 and he sleeps well. But you know, it can be those moments you're like, I would rather sleep right now. Even if I'm not feeling great, I put my feet on the ground and I try to say, it's a miracle. And just put my feet on the ground. And it's corny. I know it sounds corny. I'm a scientist. But honestly, saying it in my brain, just pause, put my feet on the ground, pause and go, it's a bleeping miracle. And then stand up and be like, right, I don't have time to make the thing. But that little thing, man, I'm telling you, big difference, big difference, huge difference in my day, the days that I do that. And I am pretty good about noticing things that are going well. I've practiced and there are good days and bad days. And, you know, and then I think really it's a great practice for reframing our relationships with loved ones and family. And that can also be quite a challenge. That can be quite a challenge for folks, but really honing in on that has made a big difference for me too. So yeah, so my thing is just general notice. I want to notice things I'm grateful for all the time. My formal practice is probably honestly putting my feet on the ground and saying it's a miracle. And then writing down the things I'm grateful for. Usually I keep that journal at my office at USC so that when I go in and I always, before I sit down, just one or two notes makes a big difference. So yeah, but I do practice it. I mean, I really do. But I think the more you practice, the easier and more fun it gets. And the more delight I think you'll derive from your internal stories about gratitude.
And hearing you speak 3 years ago at USC prompted me to start a gratitude practice, a couple of them that I've maintained to this day. So I can echo that quite a bit. I'm just curious, Glenn, what do you think the best way for someone listening is to start a gratitude practice?
Yeah, there's not really a wrong way, I guess. I would say the only thing you got to do is don't feel bad if you've never started or had a gratitude practice. I'd say the only wrong way would be to feel bad and use that guilt to start, because that's not where I want people to go with this. I don't think that's super healthy. I think the best way, honestly, we got a pen and paper, just jot down something that looks good right now. Something looks good. I don't know where you are, but something's working. Something's going well. Even in the worst day, even if something well, so I always use this. It's funny, I use this example and then I use this example of like, is your left pinky working well? If your pinky was hurting right now, it'd be all you could think about. And maybe you're thinking about other things. Maybe you're thinking about other losses, other transitions, other stressors. But hopefully your left pinky is doing well. Now I said that and then the other day I was in the workshop and I like sprained my left pinky. I did this whole example. I did this whole thing about my pinky and then I sprained it. And I was like, oh, dang it. I'm like, okay, well, I guess my thumb is working. You know, you don't want to bargain yourself into it, but something's going well. I remember, I mean, even on the morning after, you know, my mom passed away when I was in my early 30s and it had been a long battle with cancer. And I remember going to get coffee the next morning and just feeling like, I mean, I was a shell. I mean, it was a complete shell. And I remember going and having that sip of, I treated myself to like a nice a latte, and I was like, well, whatever. And I'm a shell. I'm feeling as worse as I've ever felt in my entire life so far. But I still managed to take a sip of that coffee and go, that's good. That's okay. Okay, this one microsecond, I allowed myself a nanosecond to go, that's an okay piece of coffee. And that was about, there are lower days and there are some bad ones, but even in there, you could still find, I promise, a nanosecond of gratitude. And then you can go back, but that nanosecond will expand too. So it's not a matter of being waiting for things to be good to practice gratitude. So the main thing is start right now, good day, bad day, wherever you are, whatever situation you're in, don't wait for a good day to be grateful. And don't wait for a bad day to be grateful. Like the best day is probably yesterday. And the second best day is today, as the old saying goes. And the other thing you will notice, the more you practice gratitude, the less it will be dependent on external circumstance. And the research on high performance, by the way, the research, all the work I've done with military and elite performers in the last few years before becoming an entrepreneurship professor, is that these folks will perform no matter the circumstances. And gratitude and optimism and purpose are actually independent of circumstance. When you practice them, you won't be waiting for a good or a bad day to practice gratitude. So just like right now, I'd permit anyone, as long as you're not driving, to just jot down or say, just say out loud, say it right out loud. If you're in your car right now, listen on your commute, just say something, say, look around and go, hey, that tree is looking nice or whatever, or anything, pick something. Car's running. If your car's running well, then great. There's something, but I guarantee there's something. And even if you feel like you're being dishonest about being grateful on a day that's tough, you're not. You're fundamentally, like, you're objectively not being in any sense of denial. In fact, by focusing on negative things, we're actually denying the good things just as well. So why not just have a little balance in how we set it up?
There's always the left pinky.
There's always the left pinky.
99% of the time.
Yeah, you have to, and there's always other things, right? There's always your nose, your ears, like whatever, anything. I mean, you know, as soon as your body goes, that thing becomes the main focus. But, and then you have one anytime. You can even have days where breathing is difficult, right? And, you know, a lot of times with breath is a center of things, but there can be even other things that can be pleasant to smell, look at, hear, play some music, do whatever, find something. Yeah, it's not always easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but there is something.
You mentioned the high performance work you've done with high performing athletes and military folks like Navy SEALs. And I was wondering if you could share some of the things you've learned from working with people like that, especially the SEALs.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's the most humbling work we've done. And I want to encourage people, if you're listening, we could really use your support at the C4 Foundation. That's c4foundation.org. And I'm the chief science officer of this organization. And we are one of the few charities that serve active duty Navy SEALs. And these families undergo so much stress. And we're there to support the family of the SEALs. We're supporting the SEAL as well as their whole family unit by operating this ranch outside of San Diego. And these are folks who are in a constant state of transition. My counterpart, my partner there named Jen Cooper, who's the director of programs, she talks a lot about this, how to be a Navy SEAL and to be a Navy SEAL spouse is to be in a constant state of transition. And so I've learned a lot of things. I've learned on the basic sense that our mind will quit a lot sooner than our body will for a lot of the things. Now, that can be a bad thing, by the way. Sometimes you need these things to line up, right? You need these things to line up. But the moral of the story there is that the story that we tell about what's happening is much more flexible than we give it credit and less tied to what we would think are, quote, objective scenarios. And so with the SEALs, what you're working with are humans who are like any other group of people who are really driven and motivated, but also very pro-social. The things I've learned working with the community is how funny they are. They're funny and they're like anybody else who works super hard for one goal. They're not, it's hard to paint them all with the same brush. It's that they're a diverse crew in the sense of their, how they think about their motivation and how they think about the purpose. They tend to be extremely very smart and funny and humble and everything in between, right? And so, but I've learned that this high performance population also needs rest and recovery. And that it's as true for any of us as it is for them, that they build in their whole rhythm is in to performing up to a certain buildup for a certain mission or a certain objective. And then they have a little wind down and they're looking for more of a wind down. I mean, that's where the foundation comes in. We've learned a lot. I also work with another group called the With Your Shield program at USC with my friend Greg Ciso, who's a former SEAL. And With Your Shield is a program that supports Navy SEALs as they retire from service. And they go through the same transitions that any of us do. And it's really humbling. It's really interesting that they ask the same questions that I did when I was finishing up my PhD and was not sure what I wanted to do with my career before I found entrepreneurship as like a really fun way to like focus my life and energy, a journey I'm just beginning, even now kind of at the end of the beginning of my career, so to speak. And they have the same exact questions about meaning, about identity, and about work that the rest of us do, where they're like, well, what do I do now? I've been a SEAL for 10, 20 years. And you don't, you know, when you're a SEAL, one thing, the identity of it itself is very provocative, right? It's something you can lead with. I'm a Navy SEAL. Like people would go crazy with that sentence, right? And so we run away. And the same thing we see with founders, that they, I am the company. I am this company. I founded this. I'm the founder, right? And that identity seeps into everything in terms of how we see the world. And it shows kind of, I think, the downside of too much purpose, where we lose track of our inner, truly what makes us unique by telling only a story around some external factor of the occupation that we have and identifying too strongly with that. I found in my last job running the Performance Science Institute that I found myself really identifying with this role. And it was great. And I had a lot of fun. It's how I met, how I came across you and Leah, our mutual friend. And it was great. But also I learned that like you have to have a vision of your identity that is far separate. That is an internal vision, not an external vision. I have, if anybody needs a great person to look up to, there's a gentleman at USC who's the Dean of the Office of Religious Life named Varun Soni. And Varun has this great talk on having an internal resume to match your external resume, and that the internal resume should be more important. And he's right. That's what I've learned too from Navy SEALs. And if it's true for Navy SEALs, I mean, you have to think that, and if it's true for founders and entrepreneurs, I don't think in terms of the span of human pursuit, there aren't many things more stressful than becoming a Navy SEAL or a founder, especially if a true entrepreneurial founder creating an entirely new product and marketplace. There aren't many more stressful things that we can do with our pursuits, especially when a lot's on the line, like our family and our ability to survive. It's a reason why most people have somebody else write a paycheck to them, myself included. So these are very high stakes pursuits. And if it's true for them, it's probably true for the rest of us.
And to that point, some people listening and some of the clients I work with consider becoming entrepreneurs after they leave a corporate career. And I've read over the years several studies pointing that older entrepreneurs bring several advantages to the table and can be, you know, very successful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a very robust finding. Yeah.
And based on your work with founders, what advice would you offer someone listening who's thinking about becoming an entrepreneur in their 40s, 50s, or 60s?
Well, just like you said, I mean, the more experience and the more diverse experience we have tends to predict more success as an entrepreneur or as a founder. The average age at which a successful tech venture takes off is 45 for a founder. And that's these days, I mean, that's, you still have 20 years of good power to go or more, right? I mean, thank goodness. I mean, it's a golden age for work, honestly. And so my advice would be, of course, the mindset advice and the tactical advice of, one, know your customer, of course. Find your customer and find your value proposition. Do all the product market fit. Do all that stuff, of course. And then, you know, line up with your purpose of why are you starting the company, and do some imagery of where's your entrepreneurial mindset going to come from? You know, where are you going to be, you know, motivated when things are tough? How are you going to get your first customer? And then I think the other thing is, how are you going to create and lead and manage a team with a positive, grateful culture? I think my former colleague, a guy named Noam Wasserman, who was formerly at USC, now he's the dean of a business school in New York. And he has a statistic that of ventures that fail, 35% of the failures are due to product market fit, and 65% are due to failures in the founding team. So we have, what do we spend all of our time teaching our entrepreneurs? It's all about product market fit. It's like all, that's like 99% of what we teach people. And then, well, it's probably, maybe it's 89%. So that's where my career is leading me now, is towards helping founders and business leaders work on the things that we know cause actually most of the problems that we spend the least time working on, which is our mindset.
And speaking of mindset, there's an interesting lesson I heard you share that you learned earlier in your life that involved the movie Back to the Future 3. And it's pretty clear you've carried that lesson throughout your career. I was wondering if you could just share a bit of that story and the mindset it created.
I see someone's been doing their research. So yes, when I was a kid, I was a child actor in my hometown, and I was in a lot of the local plays and anything that they kind of did up in my hometown of Sonora, California. I would try to get involved. And so they filmed Back to the Future 3 in my hometown. And this was in, I think, the late 80s, early 90s. And so I was a boy. And they had open auditions at one of the local hotels in Sonora. And because I had, well, they had first, they did these open auditions, just like a cattle call. And they said, "Barry, anyone from the town, we need extras, come on in." And so I went in and auditioned as an extra, and I got a spot as an extra. And I was over the moon. I couldn't believe it, right? So I was chosen as an extra. And then they said, "Okay, well, there's a chance to have a speaking role." And they said, we'll audition all you country bumpkins up here, but don't get your hopes up. We're going to be doing this in Hollywood too. And some Hollywood kid is going to get this. And so I was like, well, whatever. And so I managed to book the part. So I have a speaking role in Back to the Future 3. I have one line. So it's a magnificent acting debut. But what it did teach me was, you know, try your hardest all the time. And I know that's a really corny term, but it was because I'd put myself there. I gave myself permission to be there. And a lot of luck, I'm sure, I had to play. I still have no idea why they picked me. I have no idea. They had any number of people, but maybe, I don't know, maybe somebody liked me, or maybe it was, I really have no idea, but I got it. And it was just this wonderful lesson. I mean, the other lesson I learned was just how enjoyable it was to be on the set doing that work. And it really taught me the value of how you can have work and meaning, and they can align up so well. I remember just feeling like I was right where I should be. And I just felt like this is what it feels like to have everything line up. You know, I mean, I was in a total flow state as a kid there on the set. And it taught me, I mean, imagine, I learned this at age 8. It taught me, A, like, go for it. Put yourself where you feel like that. And that's what I've been chasing. It's like, I learned that that was possible at a very early age. I mean, how lucky is that to learn that was even possible, that I could be doing work. Yes, it was very competitive. And no, I mean, if I tried to be an actor now, I mean, goodness, it sounds really hard. And I'm glad I don't have to do that. But there are ways to leverage a competitive advantage for anybody. We would say the same thing for entrepreneurs and founders. You can always differentiate. You can always differentiate. And for me as a kid, being in Back to the Future, as minor as that role was in that movie, it taught me how it feels to do really cool, interesting work and to feel like I was in the perfect place at the perfect time. I've been lucky. I've had that a lot of times then because I've chased it. I've said, this is possible. This is what my standard should be. It's not always going to happen, but but I've had that my last job. I had that a lot. I had that in this job where I get to work with founders and do this kind of thing. Like I've been lucky to find this in quite a few positions. And it's been independent of the things, even if it was in graduate school or the jobs I held before graduate school. I've learned that. I've always tried to remember that this is possible, that that peak experience is always possible.
And I loved hearing you tell a story of how you got into neuroscience in the first place, which was fascinating.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's another one. I mean, it's part of what I learned from the Back to the Future was like, just your interest in doing it, just go for it. Don't wait for people to give you permission for it. I know that there's certainly some privilege involved, but I mean, I grew up without access to this kind of stuff, but I mean, I had good, great parents, but we were in Sonora, we were poor as can be, and we had nothing. And so, but my parents kind of taught me like, just chase it down, see what you get. And when I realized that anything I wanted to learn about the brain, anything I learned about the brain, I wanted to memorize. And I just thought, okay, let's do it. Let's find something. So I was at college at UC Santa Cruz and I had a great mentor and she said, well, the nearest brain imaging center is at Stanford, so go get a job there. And I was scared. Like, that's Stanford. I never thought of myself as I was a poor student. I was a good college student. I was a very good college student. By the time my junior and senior year, I was extremely serious and I didn't mess around, but I had flunked classes. I dropped out of class, out of school twice. I was a very poor high school student. I never studied. And so the idea to go to Stanford, I was like, well, they probably need help with something. And I knew I had my curiosity behind me and I knew that I could have some humility. And I also knew that they're just people. So I literally just wandered the halls of their psych department until I stumbled into a guy's office. His name is Bob Doherty. He's a fantastic scientist, probably the best scientist. Happened to stumble into like one of the best science laboratories on the planet. I had no idea. And just said, I heard you guys are looking for a research assistant. And he said, well, we actually gave that position to someone who's actually qualified, but if you want to get some experience. And so I was just like, look, I'm going to be here. Like, what do you want me to do? And let me just volunteer then. And he said, okay, I guess so. And so I drove over there and I gave 20 hours a week to this lab. And then they gave me a career. I mean, it was huge. And they didn't care one way or the other where I was from. It turns out they just said, cool, show up, work hard and try to contribute. And if you contribute, good things will happen. And that was how it worked. I mean, there are so many funny, hilarious coincidences in there as well. If you have time for one final story here to follow your coincidence. But the first day I showed up, so I'd gotten this position as a research assistant, a volunteer research assistant at Stanford. And they had agreed to this. And then I realized hot water I was in because I had no idea about anything, period. I didn't know what part of the brain we'd be studying. I didn't know what the brain was. I showed up and I was like, oh my goodness, I am in trouble. I have no idea what I'm doing here. And so the first question Bob asked me was, do you want to study structural or functional imaging? This is, as a neuroscientist now, I know this is the most basic question ever. It's, do you want to study the structure of the brain or do you want to study what the brain does? And I, in that moment, had no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea. I was like, I don't know, but I know that I like cars. I like things. I'm a mechanic. So I was like, oh, structural sounds good. I'd like to learn structural. And he was like, nobody picks that. And he literally was like, oh, funny. People don't really pick that very often, but all right, cool. That's good. We need the most help there. I was like, yeah, that'll be good. And I still was like, oh man, what did I sign up for? And turned out I loved structural brain imaging. It's very meticulous. And so you're tracing brains. You're literally have a computer screen and you're tracing them. And that was where I got my experience. So I worked with them for about a year. And then a job opened up at USC with Juan and Antonio Damasio, who are very well-known neuroscientists. And they were starting their lab and needed a research assistant. So I managed to leverage a connection and I got an interview with Antonio. I was terrified, but at least I'd had this experience from Stanford and I was well-prepared and as well as you could be to meet with one of the most eminent neuroscientists alive. And the funny thing was I met with Antonio and he said, I like that you have all this structural experience. Not many people have structural experience. That is really smart. That was really smart of you to get structural experience because this is where we need the most help. And I was just like, yeah, structural. It's always been passionate of my, you know, it's been a big passion. So it was a flip of the coin, but that's how I got my job with Antonio. If I'd known what it was, I would have picked functional. Of course I would have picked functional. fMRI is so cool. It took me years to get back into it. I totally would have picked it if I'd known what I was talking about. The fact that I didn't, I just rode this wave. So it wasn't lucky. I mean, I was giving away. I was working at that time in order to support myself. When I was at Stanford, I had that volunteer job for 20 hours a week and I still had to pay rent and bills. So I sold a car. I was doing any odd job I could to support myself. So I was absolutely hustling to get on my feet. So when Antonio kindly put me on staff there, it was like, okay, I've got a little bit of breathing room. But the funniest thing was realizing just how hilarious it was, because I didn't put two and two together for a long time, that it was just, I just happened to say, it's a flip of a coin. I had no idea what the difference was. I had no idea. And it's literally how I got this stuff done. Other good stuff would have happened because I'm a hustler, but the fact that this like grand slam hire that I was able to get with the Damasios came from a total flip of the coin, that like ignorant answer. So anyway, I hope that last little story encourages people. Just go get curious. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? You know, just chase after it and see where you end up.
And the persistence too. You know, the enthusiasm that you talked about is really, really there. So we're grateful for your choice in that moment, the coin flip, landing the right way, and for the work that you've done sharing your insights with us. Is there anything you'd like to end on? Any last word on gratitude that you'd like to leave people with?
No, thanks everyone. I mean, of course you can connect with me on LinkedIn, easy to find. And I'd appreciate if folks want to join me on Twitter at Glenn R. Fox, GlennRFox. I'm starting to get a little bit more into social media. So I tweet about gratitude and mindset, and then I send pictures of some of the projects that I work on around here. So pretty low-key follow, but I would love to connect with people online. That's a lot better than email, where I get a million emails a day. So following me on social media is the best way if people want to engage.
And we'll have links to those in the show notes. But Glenn, thank you so much for taking the time. We're grateful you did it.
Thank you all. Thank you so much, Joe. Keep in touch.
I'm grateful that Glenn Fox could take the time to share his insights on gratitude with us today. I'm also grateful I heard him speak about 3.5 years ago to a class I was taking. It was the last class in a master's program in gerontology at USC. Small class, small group, but really powerful class taught by Professor Leah Boutrine. And it just had a great impact on me in many ways. And that day I heard him, I started a gratitude practice that I have kept up to this day. And so I can really reinforce a lot of things he said from a practitioner standpoint. The benefits are real. So I'd encourage you to think of it. I'm going to share 3 takeaways I wrote down in the hopes that it will inspire you to write your own list and reflect on what are you taking away from this that you can apply, or perhaps these might inspire you to take some action. Takeaway 1 is gratitude's a skill. It's an interesting way to think about it. And he mentioned that there are 3 things that are correlated with subjective well-being. My quick translation of that is, that's how you answer to yourself when someone asks you, how are you doing really? And he put it, your psychological well-being. And those 3 are gratitude, purpose, and optimism. He also noted that all 3 are learnable. So why not start with gratitude? Takeaway 2, drop the guilt trip. Don't tell yourself or others you should be grateful. Be more grateful. Instead, practice your attentiveness to things around you that are good or going well. And as he noted, there's always something. If in doubt, go with the left pinky. And 3, you don't have to necessarily do it every day. That's an interesting finding that he noted, that you can do this once a week or a couple times a week and get a lot of benefit. And I've seen some of the research he alluded to, which says actually may even be more powerful if it's less than daily. But just start. And start by jotting some things down that you are grateful for, that you notice are going well. And I loved his tip about a gratitude journal. In particular, putting it in a place where you have to move it. Brilliant. Put it in the middle of your desk like he does, or a nightstand, or somewhere where you're going to encounter it. You're going to have to move it to get started, put it on top of your laptop, etc., whatever. It'll spur you to take action. Make it easy for you to cultivate this habit. But the important thing is to start. And with practice, you'll begin to reap some very powerful benefits. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Our mission is to help you really design a new life after you choose to leave the world of full-time work behind. Your life is multidimensional and your planning for retirement transcends the financial. And we help people design that new future. You can browse all of our episodes at our website, retirementwisdom.com. You can also schedule a call if you're interested in hearing more about our Designing Your Life programs, both one-on-one, and we have a new group program that's kicking off in January. Look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.